Welcome, everyone, to the first Global Food Outlook Food Safe virtual exchange. This one focuses on food safety. My name is Miriam Lewick-Avery, co-director of the Global Food Outlook program here at the Institute for the Future, and I'm delighted to welcome you all here this morning, along with our guests, Leslie Chesson and Tejas Bhatt. So for the next 90 minutes, we're going to start, I'm going to share with you a scenario, and I'm going to introduce our panelists and ask them a little bit about what they're doing. And after that, we'll open things up to a broader discussion. And for all of you who are there online and on the phone, I invite you to ask questions at any time. Please use the chat function in WebEx to ask your questions. My lovely research assistant, Sarah, who is just off camera, is collating your questions and organizing them and passing them back to me. For the purposes of sort of clarity and a clear sound space, I ask that all of you mute your phones, except for my guests and myself, here in the room. And for those of you here in the room with me, my colleagues at the Institute for the Future, I ask that you please take a moment to silence your phones for the same reason. We are not only broadcasting this live, but we are also recording this, and it will be available for streaming after we've concluded here today. So I wanted to make you all aware of that. And again, thank you very much for joining us. And I wanted to start by sharing a story of constraint. And it starts really with a series of food safety crises. Just as the poultry industry was starting to rebound from a deadly outbreak this year, in 2013, cattle started dying off in droves to an extent that we hadn't seen since the mad cow disease scare in 2001 and 2002. By the time of, that the cause of that was identified, one in five industrial meat producers had slaughtered their entire stock. And just as we were recovering from that, it turned out that an element of feed in pork was actually causing some problems for human health. And herds and herds of pork stocks were also slaughtered. And this chain of events really shook consumer confidence in the safety of meat supplies and, indeed, of the back and forth of international trade in protein and processing. In an effort to find safer protein, people started turning to fish, and fisheries, already stressed by ocean acidification and overfishing, started to collapse in droves. The rallying cry all over the world became, know your farmer, eat local, eat plants. This was easier said than done, and really what we see over the next decade in this world is a struggle to live within the constraints of a desire for simplicity and a desire for trust, really directly through personal relationships and a personal assurance that fear is unfounded. Now, this might be a quite extreme scenario, and that really is the spirit in which it's offered. This is one of our four alternative future scenarios that we released just this past year. And its purpose is really to stretch the boundaries of what we can imagine as a possible future. And I share it with you here today because it really highlights two facets of the future of food safety that have really fascinated us here at the Institute for the Future, and we've been studying since 2009 or so. And those are really the complexity of our food system and the vulnerabilities that that can create, and fear of food contamination, fear of illness from what we eat, and the flip side of that, which is trust in the system and how that can be nurtured. And that really is why we've asked our two special guests here today. Tejas works at the Institute for Food Technologists, a professional organization based in Washington, D.C., and his job is really to make the future of food safety by examining the technologies and techniques that could make a safer food system, both in the United States and imagining what that could look like around the world. And so we'll hear a little bit about his work in a few minutes. And when it comes to fear and trust, that's really what drew us to the work of Leslie Chessen, a scientist both at the University of Utah and at her company Isoforensics. And what she's trying to do is bring chemistry to bear on the question of origin and authenticity, and assuring that something is what it says it is, it is from where it says it's from, and by extension, other claims about its safety can be assured. And together, I want to have a conversation about what our capacities are in going forward in looking at our food system and understanding how we can become more proactively resilient about how we protect our access to food and the safety of that food, and emotionally, how we relate to that and how we strengthen and create new ways of trusting our food supplies and avoiding that devastating fear that is such an adaptive part of our relationship with food. Fear of things that will make you sick if you eat them is an incredibly adaptive emotion that has served us very well in the past, and how do we bring it to bear on the complexities of the food system today and over the next 10 years. Again, I want to reiterate that you can at any time ask questions in chat, and we'll filter those in, and I'll add those to the questions that I'm asking our guests today. And with that, I'd like to invite first Tejas. Could you tell us a little bit about your work and how it's shaping the future of food safety?
Sure, Miriam. First off, thank you to you and the Institute for the Future for inviting IFT to be a part of this panel. I'm delighted to be here, and I think the questions that we will be discussing today, the scenarios that we'll be discussing today, are going to be insightful, perhaps frightening at times, but these are questions that we should be asking and having an open discussion with everyone involved in the food system, which is all 7 billion of us. So give our audience a brief background on what I do here at IFT. I am the manager of food safety programs, and on a day-to-day basis, I help manage the IFT's research in food safety. My primary expertise is in food traceability. How do you use food traceability to enhance food safety, if you will? My background is I have a master's in food science from Purdue University, as well as a bachelor's in computer science. So I usually play two roles in any given situation: how to use technology to make things better, and how do you ensure the safety of foods as they're produced today in the world, but also going forward in the future. What does that look like? How can we make things better? How can we improve it? The scenario that you described right now, while might seem far-fetched, I don't think it's implausible. There is a series of unfortunate events that can lead to that conclusion. And I know a lot of hardworking food scientists, as well as regulatory agencies, academia, industry folks, and consumer groups that are working to prevent that from ever happening in the real world. So I'm excited to be a part of this panel. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Leslie, could you please share a little bit about your work at Isoforensics and
Absolutely.
How it's making the future of food safety?
Absolutely. I will second Tejas's thank you very much for inviting me to be a part of this. I'm looking forward to the discussion. So the work that we do at Isoforensics and the work that I'm involved with is using stable isotope analysis, a particular type of chemical analysis, to investigate claims of origin and authenticity. And it's not just food that's my primary concern, but here at the company, we actually investigate a lot of other materials as well. The sky's the limit, really. We can apply this technique to drugs, to fibers, to feathers. We've pretty much tested as many things as possible to see if these techniques will help in understanding where things are from and if they're being made the way that they claim to be made. So my interest, of course, is in food, as I said, and the reason I'm interested in food is because that's what I got my master's degree in at the University of Utah, looking at where is the American diet coming from? How is it being produced? And can I use stable isotope analysis to understand how we're sourcing our food in a very complex society today?
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about how this technique works and how you can identify where food is from with your work?
Yes, absolutely. So stable isotopes exist naturally in nature, and they are basically unique chemical forms of elements that you remember from high school chemistry class. And these natural abundance levels we can measure with very specialized instruments. And those isotopes tell us something about how a particular food item or a particular material was produced or where it's from. And the reason it tells us that is because isotopes are actually impacted by the environment. So the environmental conditions that material would experience as it was being grown or as it was being produced, as it was eating a particular diet, is recorded in that material. So a great example is a bottled water. Just because you purchased a bottle of water and it says it's from a particular location doesn't necessarily mean it is. But water around the world has unique chemical isotope signatures. And so we can go and test those isotope signatures in a bottle of water and say, is that really from the particular spring that it claimed to be from? And we can then take those same techniques and look at an animal that drank that water or a plant that was watered with a particular water source, it recorded those same isotopes. And so now we have a technique to go and look at where something's coming from based on just these particular chemical fingerprints that the material recorded.
And right now this is sort of a bulky process, but it is getting much, much smaller and more accessible.
Yes. The initial start for this work started in geology almost 100 years ago and really developed in the academic community because the instrumentation that's needed to analyze stable isotopes is pretty large. It requires a large footprint, lots of training to run the instrumentation, and it really stayed in the academic field, which is why I came from a university and moved over to a private company. This is the bread and butter of the academic community. Now, what has started happening is that the footprint for these instruments is getting smaller because we're getting new developments in analysis techniques. And all of a sudden, instead of needing a giant instrument that requires lots of training to run, I can actually build a desktop model, something that I could put in the back of a car, like the trunk of a car or in the back of an airplane, and I could run it anywhere, and I need very little training to get someone to actually turn it on and to start analyzing samples. And so these new instruments have opened up a whole new world into where we can make measurements. They're faster, they're easier to transport. And so instead of wondering how do I get a material from the field or from its collection location to the lab, I can take an instrument to my material and measure real time and figure out at that moment what I need to know about that sample.
Mm-hmm. And that really opens up not just where you can use it, but also who can use it. So, for instance, some of your work with students.
Yes, we have started working now with high school students. We actually have a lot of different, not isotope analyzers, but other analyzers that we've installed at schools, and we're starting to show elementary, middle school, and high school students how we use these instruments. We're bringing them into our labs. We're letting them play around with our instruments. They're coming up with these crazy ideas to test their school lunches, to test the grass-fed beef that they just bought at the store. And it has been a lot of fun to sort of introduce this technique to another generation.
Now that scaling really is one enabler of applying your technique to many of these issues. And I'd like to ask Tejas next, what are some of the technological enablers that you've encountered in your work that really excite you, that really make you feel a lot of hope for the future of the food system?
Sure. So maybe as a good segue or a follow-up to what Leslie was talking about, there are some food traceability technologies out there that we've encountered. While they're not very widely adopted, probably because they're more state-of-the-art right now and more nascent in its use, there are some food technology companies that actually add inert elements with unique isotopes as an ingredient to food products so that you can check for the authenticity and the origins of where that food product came from when it's consumed at the retail level. So not only checking for naturally occurring isotopes, as Leslie mentioned, in water, but intentionally adding inert isotopes to foods so that you can track it along its entire supply chain. So I think that's very exciting and fascinating. How widely that would be adopted is a different issue. But the other technology that I've seen more recently, several of them have used this concept of social networking to include consumers into the whole area of foodborne outbreak disease epidemiology. So really looking at, you might have heard of the fact that Google was able to predict the start of the flu season before CDC could. And the reason they could do that was because they mined this social network data that they have through searches on the web. And a lot of food traceability technologies are trying to leverage that rich information source through a peer-to-peer network and try to stay ahead of the game, so to speak, and give more power, more empowerment to the consumers to take charge of their own health and protect them from consuming something that could potentially be contaminated.
Now that sort of a predictive approach really ties into something you and I were discussing the other day of a sort of shift towards more proactive approaches to food safety and defense. Much of our system right now is based on a sort of reactive model of identifying a threat and then creating protocols to prevent that threat based on what we observe. What are some other sort of more proactive examples of bringing not just ability but really foresight in some ways to how we keep our food system safe?
So some of that is already happening to the implementation of the Food Safety Modernization Act, where the focus of food safety, at least the intent behind that law, is to transition the paradigm from reactive to proactive. Now, how that plays out over the next coming years is for us to wait and see. But essentially, we have seen over the last, let's say, last 5 years or so, we have encountered more and more food borne outbreaks associated with microbial hazards that were never previously associated with that food. We can debate what the reason for that is, but essentially what that highlights is the fact that by taking an all hazards approach, by looking at it from a holistic perspective, by not being very focused on one particular type of control or hazard, we can be more proactive as a food system. I'm not talking about just the food industry. I'm not talking about just consumers or regulatory agencies. But holistically, we can work together to stay ahead of the game and to minimize the impact. I don't think we'll ever get to a point where everything will be 100% safe. That's just not practically possible. But if we can monitor weak signals and act on those weak signals before they become strong signals, that gives us an upper hand.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the techniques that you're investigating to really be aware of those weak signals? You mentioned the sort of Google Analytics and the social network analysis. So there's some other techniques that really help build that awareness.
So there are a couple of things that I can see. I can see a trend that's coming up in the near future. It could be 5 years from now or maybe a little bit later. But essentially, there are two trends. One is a bottoms-up approach where we empower consumers to not only make their own decisions with better information, but to help provide information to regulatory agencies or the food industry, provide feedback. So a bottoms-up approach would be the general population consuming a food, something going wrong with that food, someone falling sick, and instead of waiting for that person to go to the hospital notifying the local health agency, the local health agency notifying the state health agency, the state health agency notifying CDC, and then the CDC notifying FDA, you can imagine how long that takes. But if the person tweeted that they were sick and these were their symptoms, and there was an analytical tool that CDC was using to capture these trends in information, social network information, it just makes it a very powerful tool. The other side of the flip side of the equation is the top-down approach, which is the food industry itself trying to do a better job, trying to be more proactive in having better visibility in their supply chain and having better control in their supply chain. You discussed at the start of this session that the food system is complex. It's a complicated web of systems. And it's very easy today to lose visibility of where your food comes from. So if the food industry does a better job at informing the consumers of where their foods are coming from, there's a much higher likelihood of us being proactive in capturing some link that is broken, some problem that has occurred in one part of the supply chain, and really acting on that information before it gets to the consumer.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like part of what you're saying is not just that consumers and the industry have better access to tools to verify origins and safety, but that this becomes sort of routine, that treating sort of outbreaks and hazards one at a time is whack-a-mole. And really, our path to safety is really considering analyzing our food and sharing our food and sharing that information is a way to make the whole system more resilient. But bringing in that expectation that this isn't an anomaly, that this is an everyday practice.
Absolutely. So one example I tend to use is the fact that one of the greatest challenges today for foodborne illness outbreak investigation by CDC or FDA is really the whole concept of interviewing the consumers that felt sick to find out what they consumed, do a food history, so to speak. Well, what if you use their Instagram pictures, because we know we all take pictures of the food we eat, and then use that as a food history to see what you had over the last 2 weeks or a month. You know, that's a very powerful thing for the regulators. So it needs to be a dialogue. It needs to be a two-way thing, but absolutely it needs to be an ongoing thing as opposed to an event.
So that's sort of the distinction between sort of paying attention and identifying hazards. Leslie, I was wondering if we could go back to you and you could speak a little bit more about, we've talked about traceability, but really thinking about authenticity and what is the relationship of authenticity and the trust that authenticity brings to food safety?
Well, the way that we think about authenticity here at Isoforensics, and I have thought about it during my research and work, is, are you being truthful? And you could be the farmer who tells me that this is how I'm raising my cows. You could be the food producer who said this is cheese from a particular region or wine made a particular year. And I want to now independently verify that in some way because I put some trust in you by that label or by that claim. And I have made my trust statement in a purchase. So I've spent dollars in a particular way because I think that you are doing the right thing or you're doing the safe thing or you're doing the thing that I believe in. And so now, how do we authenticate that? How do we verify that this is really what's going on? And a lot of my work has been looking for these unique chemical markers that we can analyze in a lab or using in the, perhaps in the field with one of these new analyzers, but actually get some true data to say, here's an independent verification or test of this claim, not to particularly call out all of the bad guys, but you know, to say, I know now that I am choosing to spend this food dollar the way that I want to. And I think not only for a from a consumer point of view, which is how I view a lot of this, because I will say my thesis work completely changed the way that I food shopped and that I identified farmers that I liked to work with and who I really thought were doing the right thing. And I still go to them today because it really changed how I view the food industry here in the United States. But you have food producers who are honestly trying to do the right thing and are having to trust their supply chain, which Tejas mentioned. It's so complex. Are there ways that we can come and say, this supply chain is doing what I really think it's supposed to be doing, and I, as a producer, am spending my dollar in a way that I want to spend it to get the supplies that I want. Now I need to verify that that's really what I'm getting.
Could you give me some examples from your work of things that really were what they said they were and things that really weren't what they said they were? So, for instance, we were talking earlier about safety and the strong feeling of many consumers that organic foods are the safest.
Yes. So one of the students that I actually went to graduate school with now teaches an organic gardening class, and he approached me a couple of years ago and said, my students are really interested in organic food production. We have an organic garden here on campus, but we can't grow everything all year round. And so the students are really interested in understanding if the organic produce they're buying at a grocery store is what they think they're paying for. And so we set out to collect all sorts of organic produce, both from their garden and then that they bought at, you know, sort of one of these super chain grocery stores. So you walk in and they have everything you can imagine all year round. And they also bought what were not labeled organic, so these conventionally produced lettuce leaves and kale and so on and so forth. And we analyzed all of them for nitrogen isotopes, and we actually found no cheaters for the organic producers. And I'll admit I was surprised. I thought, oh, we're going to find someone. We're going to find someone who is labeling as organic and it's not going to fit what we expect. And it wasn't the case. So that was pretty exciting to me. And I think the students actually really enjoyed it as well. They pushed for us to do another study the next year. So it was nice to see them getting engaged and excited that they were spending their food dollar the way that they thought they were.
Mm-hmm. And how about an example of something that really wasn't what it says it said it was, that surprised you in the distance of the claim to the reality?
One of the biggest cheats that we found is not from concentrated juice. So you go and you buy this fresh squeezed juice. You particularly see it for citrus juices, orange juice, and grapefruit juice. And we have looked at a lot of not from concentrate juices and found you actually look like you were reconstituted. So you were a concentrate at one point and were then reconstituted at some point along the line. It changed the way that I bought orange juice, I'll admit. I found a brand that I thought, you're doing the right thing and I'm sticking with you. So that was a little bit of an eye-opener for me.
Mm-hmm. And what about, so that's something where the process was really not quite what it claimed to be, and you could tell that from this technique.
But what about actual adulteration or serious contamination of food? So sort of most proximally in the United States and in Canada, we think about the melamine contamination of milk and pet foods and foods with gluten in them. And that's a very extreme example, but can you talk a little bit about how we can use this to understand those issues?
So the isotope analysis techniques that I use are great for some adulteration questions, and others, they are not as great. And one particular area that you mentioned, melamine, we haven't come to consensus as a community about whether isotope analysis is going to be useful for that particular question. It has been extremely useful for another highly adulterated food, honey. And I just saw another article earlier this week that there are all of these honey producers now coming out of the United States and saying, oh, we're not actually really selling you honey. We're selling you a mixture of corn syrup and cane sugar that we've diluted in water, and it's not actually where it says it's from. And yes, we'll pay a lot of fines for that, but they still made a lot of profit in the meantime while they were selling something as real honey that actually wasn't. And isotope analysis has been used to detect honey adulteration for years. In fact, the USDA has a lab that tests imported honey. Honey coming into the United States, they will test it isotopically and make sure that it really is honey. Now, they can't test every barrel, and so there are ways around this that some of these importers are getting. It's an arms race, almost. You develop a technique to test, I'm going to be smarter, or I'm going to be wilier, and I'm going to come around you and say, oh, that didn't come from this particular region that you want to test. It came from another region that's safe. Well, no, you shipped honey, relabeled it, and then brought it in from a safe country. So that honey has been the big adulteration example for the stable isotope community for a long time.
And I mean, particularly with honey, but really across the board, both the dangers, the real dangers to human health, and the fears that people feel are really acute in China. And we've uncovered this in our ethnographic work, in our technology scans, that there's a huge demand for a sort of consumer safety authentication device to assure that food is what it says it is, and that it's also safe.
And where else
in the world do you think there's really a demand that this might unfold outside of North America, and really sort of change the way that other parts of the system, of this global system, work?
Well, I think there is a huge demand in Europe. The European Union has been using stable isotope analysis techniques along with a lot of other chemical analysis techniques that detect melamine and can detect pesticide, hormones, things that we don't want in our food. The European Union has been doing this for years, and one of the reasons for that is there are many regions in the European Union that are protected domains of origin. So food from this particular region can be labeled a special way and could demand a higher premium price, and they want to find ways to protect that designation. So they've been looking for these independent verification tools. Some of them have to do with paperwork, so can you provide the necessary paperwork that says this is what it is, but now we need these analysis techniques as well. Another region we've seen really invest a lot in this is New Zealand, as a matter of fact, especially with honey. Manuka honey from New Zealand has a lot of health benefits, and they want to make sure that the Manuka honey that is ending up on shelf outside of that country is really representing New Zealand, because they don't ever want to have a case where someone says, this Manuka honey made me sick, or this Manuka honey isn't what it says it is. That is just not at all what they want to happen, because they know, these Manuka honey producers know they're producing the right stuff, the good stuff, but that's not necessarily what we're getting outside of New Zealand.
Now, going back to you, Tejas, we were discussing the other day about the balance of looking at the complexity of domestic systems, but also with the knowledge that we have a truly global food system, how do we understand how to keep up with food safety issues when even at the relatively local scale, transparency is so difficult?
That's, it's an incredible challenge, no doubt. As you stated, we are making significant progress domestically when it comes to improving food safety or improving food traceability. But with increasing number of food products being imported into the U.S., because of consumer preferences and choices and demands, it is imperative that not only at the regulatory level, countries coordinate or harmonize their food safety requirements, standards, techniques. You know, we've seen that happen certainly within North America, but also in the EU, and more recently, happy to see some movement and progress in China with their new food safety laws. When you evaluate how they connect with each other, it's encouraging to see that there is some kind of harmonization. It's not always exactly the same. But interestingly, the driving force here is not food safety, but it's trade. It's economic. The World Trade Organization takes up any kind of claims where if there is an undue or unnecessary regulatory burden for imports versus domestically produced foods or goods in general, that kind of helps keep in check any kind of dramatic variances in food safety laws. So the economic factor is a more important driving force, in my view, to make sure that it's all at the same level. I want to go back to one thing that Leslie was talking about in the previous conversation was, you know, where do we see this trend or increasing demand for the need for authenticate the origin of foods? And honestly speaking, as you can imagine, any region of the world, any area of the world where food security is not a problem, where access to food is not a problem, the next important question the consumer should ask and will ask is the food safe? So when you're talking about developed countries, you're talking about developing countries, you're talking about BRIC countries, certainly, for the most part, food security is not the issue today or in the near future. And that's why the conversation has moved to the level of food safety. But in places where you don't have access to food, if the choice is between no food and food that is made from, or honey that is made from corn syrup, I'm probably going to go for honey that is made from corn syrup because I don't want to be hungry. So we have to keep that in perspective when we're talking about the need for authentication and the need for food safety. There absolutely is a need, but there is also a need for securing access to food first.
Now, so you put that in terms of an order of operations, and I think from a consumer and eater experience perspective, that's absolutely correct. But aren't they somewhat intertwined in terms of if you're going to build capacity, to build it in a safe way? And is that conversation happening in those circles, or is it really viewed as a separate issue between food safety and food security?
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. They are intertwined with each other. So when I was saying that, I was saying it from the consumer's perspective. I know a lot of my colleagues and a lot of different food scientists that are members of IFT are working on developing new techniques, whether it's processing or whether it's packaging, to make sure that the food that we produce in the developed and developing countries can be stored and distributed to the people that need it in a safe and secure manner. So there are a lot of innovations in the pipeline that would help us do that. I use this as an example, but as you can imagine, the whole charge for NASA to have a manned mission to Mars is having a dramatic impact on how we create and store foods for long periods of time. So, you know, the whole trip to Mars and back is supposed to take, I think, 500 days or something. And the question is, how do we make sure that the foods that the astronauts take with them are safe to consume over that period of time? Now, we can use that same technology, and food scientists at NASA are working on that, to take foods that are safe from the developed world, from the developing worlds, and provide it to the ones that need it today.
Could you give me some examples of those technologies that are really being supported and enabled by that particular drive to Mars?
So I don't have the details of what they're working on, but there are two things that I think are being evaluated. One is really what the foods should be in terms of nutrition density and nutrition content. And the second thing is, how can we preserve it? So assuming you have good food, how do you make sure it does not rot over time? And to me, in my mind, how they do it should easily translate to how we operate in the food industry, in the food system today. And over time, use the same technology to help prevent, you know, there's a lot of conversations around agricultural production and agricultural growth in crop production. But what do you do once you have all that corn and once you have all that rice and all that wheat? How do you make sure that you can preserve that post-harvest and deliver it to the ones that need it? So it's certainly intertwined. It's certainly we're all trying to achieve the same objectives. I'm excited to see these innovations in these niche areas like Mission to Mars and how that would translate to a day-to-day operations in the food system.
Mm-hmm. Are there other sort of niche or left field drivers that you can see really impacting this area?
I couldn't hear that. Could you say it again?
Like the Mission to Mars, are there other sort of niche or left field drivers that you see really bringing exciting innovations to this area?
Two come to mind. And both of these are really innovations that I see in other industries that hopefully will be modified and adopted in the food industry. So as you can imagine, the whole area of food, water, and energy security are related. In fact, IFT is working on an initiative to come up with the dialogue on how do we solve those three interrelated problems. You know, we've heard a lot about alternative energy and the trying to move away from fossil fuels and into renewable fuels. Now the way we do that and the technologies involved in creating that alternative energy field has a similar translation to the food world. And by that I mean, we've had a discussion in the food industry about renewable foods and renewable, sustainable agriculture and production. So if we can learn the lessons that the energy industry is learning today and try and minimize any kind of redundant efforts, I can see that in the near future, in the next 5 to 10 years, we will come up in the food industry with techniques like packaging that is not a one-time use, for example. I think there was something about that in your report as well that talks about the fact that the whole concept of using a package for food and throwing it away is just wasteful. So what are the other applications of that package that can be used along with the protection of food? So that's one thing, the lessons learned from the energy industry. The second thing I try to compare with is the whole concept of how the aerospace industry has come together. As you can imagine, there are a lot of different parts and a lot of different supply chains to bring together one airplane.
Mm-hmm.
They have dealt with the same supply chain visibility issues and quality issues in the past, and the stakes for them are about as high as they are for the food industry, right? If something goes wrong with an aircraft, it's disastrous for everyone. So we have
for safety and for trust. Yeah.
Exactly. So we have parallels between the aerospace industry and the food industry, and I'm excited to see how we can learn from them.
Great, thank you. Now, one of the questions that I asked you to think about is really thinking about the notion of wild cards and what are high impact possibilities that you can imagine that are either very low probability or just low credibility. Very few people are talking about them or taking them seriously. And just as an example, something that we've been thinking about, particularly in our 10-year forecast research that's about to be released, and in our Health Horizons research that's being released in the next few months, is really about the role of microbes and a sort of paradigm shift from understanding microbes only as hazards, as you say, and only hazards that we recognize, but really recognizing a larger ecosystem and learning how to manage that ecosystem rather than focusing on sterility. So that's, I think, a very powerful shift. I think whether or not that really manifests in a powerful way in the next decade is what makes it a wild card. So with that as a sort of jumping off point, Tess, would you like to share a little bit about what possibilities you can imagine that are really high impact, but either low probability or that nobody is paying attention to?
I'll give it a try. And I'm hoping that Leslie's answer is more optimistic because mine is not. There are, in terms of the whole microbial management perspective that you just offered, I had previously mentioned that we need to take an all-hazards approach and not just look at one food and one hazard at a time, because that's a losing battle for us. But really, the question I ask is, can we apply the lessons that we have learned through the whole prebiotics and probiotics area of research, where we have learned that there are some types of cultures that are beneficial to us, and there are some types of cultures that help us get the maximum benefit from the foods that we eat. Now, I don't have an answer to this, but the obvious next question is there a way that we can manage the microbes that are bound to exist in our foods to maximize the benefits that we can get from it? Now, that could be two things. One is it could be adding cultures or microbes to the foods to inhibit the ones that can cause us harm, or it could be adding ingredients or combining ingredients in a way that allow the non-harmful ones to flourish while the harmful ones to die off. So I think that's an exciting field, and there is great potential there. Hopefully something good will come out of that in the future. But aside from that, my prediction or my scenario for a dramatic change in the future, disruptive change in the future, is really this whole concept around food-related terrorism. I do a lot of my research, and my previous work has been in food defense-related activities. And I know that a lot of folks at the FDA are taking this very seriously, and I know that folks at DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, are taking this very seriously. But in general, when you talk to the industry or when you talk to the consumer, they're not that concerned about food-related terrorism as a serious concern today. But in my view, given that energy prices are bound to rise, given that climate change is going to dramatically change the way we produce foods, I see it very likely, not very likely, but very high impact scenario that we might end up with a situation where there are people in the world that have a lot of production capabilities and people in the world that don't. And it's going to create this imbalance that may result in and concerted, coordinated effort into food-related terrorism for political gains, for economic gains, and perhaps just for survival. The food industry today does not think a lot about that for obvious reasons. As we talked before, the first thing is access to food. Second thing is food safety. And then if you have accomplished both of those, then you might think about food defense. But in my view, they're all related, and they all need to be thought about. It's a losing battle if you don't think of it from a holistic perspective.
Could you tell me a little bit more from the research and from the thinking that you've done about what a food terrorism scenario might look like? How would we experience it as consumers? How would the food industry experience it were it to actually come to pass? Can you give us some examples?
Yes, I can. It's a little scary, but so as a part of my master's work, my thesis work, we had created a model and a simulation of the about the food supply chain of about 60 different products in the U.S. So it was a domestic supply chain. It was a simulation model of the domestic supply chain. And then we got a bunch of graduate students to come up with scenarios to essentially think like terrorists and come up with scenarios that were plausible today where someone, it could be a disgruntled employee or it could be someone who is an actual terrorist and wants to inflict harm and cause panic in the U.S. So we came up with several scenarios where you could add ingredients or add microbes or add toxins to a very limited quantity of ingredients the way they're manufactured today. But the way those ingredients are used in the complex web of the food system, it would impact millions of people. And because they were toxins that were not traditionally tested for, they would go virtually undetected till the consumer started falling sick, by which time it would be too late for any intervention. So the simulation models that we ran, we could prove using those models that it is a very plausible scenario that one or two individuals can make millions of people sick if they knew what they were doing. And had the opportunity to introduce contaminants. But more interestingly, we found that if the industry fails at preventing this from happening, the economic impact from not just the loss of public health lives, but the economic impact from recalls, from all the food that would be destroyed or wasted or discarded, was in the billions. So that was a very scary scenario. And we vetted this with hundreds of industry experts to see if this was a plausible scenario or were we just making this up in our heads. And almost everyone agreed that it was plausible that this could happen today.
And what are some of the reactions to that, of what you do about that in terms of your holistic system of defense and as well as safety?
Well, one good thing that happened for me was I got a lot of job offers. but seriously speaking, it was eye-opening to almost anyone that we spoke to within the industry on what kind of an impact they could have. The traditional reaction to any kind of to this kind of information,
mm-hmm.
really, this could never happen to me, right? This could happen to someone else, but I know what I'm doing and I'm protected. But as we got into the details of explaining the scenarios that we had created for food terrorism scenarios, they began to realize that the only way to solve these problems is not by hiring a food safety expert, is not by hiring more guards at the door, but it's by having a more cross-disciplinary team of people working on this, including folks from upper management, including people on the floor, including all your employees into the conversation of having awareness of looking for something that is suspicious, and having the credibility and the empowerment to act on something if they see something. So it's really a change in a paradigm shift in management style that needs to happen. It's not adding more locks. It's not just putting more surveillance. It's really allowing a more cross-disciplinary approach to solve these problems.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. So really participation rather than that whack-a-mole game we were talking about earlier. Leslie, what are some high-impact possibilities that you can imagine that are either low probability or that people aren't really thinking about or really taking seriously?
Well, I will say that mine is probably going to be a little bit more positive than Tejas's, because that scenario is very scary. I'm not going to lie. That is pretty terrifying.
And if I could just pause for 1 second and invite at this point, if people want to start asking questions in chat, so we can organize those and move on to those. I'm sorry, Leslie, please continue.
No, that's fine.
Yeah.
Chaos is a great point, that a lot of the traceability techniques and a lot of the traceability concerns really impact people who have a secure food source. Not secure in terms of safety, but I know that I can always get food, or I know that I'm going to go to the grocery store and there will be food on the shelves. Mm-hmm. Thinking from that consumer's point of view, however, I would love to see a scenario where a consumer could walk into a grocery store and look at what was on the shelf and know exactly where every single ingredient in that food product came from, how it was produced, who produced it. Now, some of the techniques that I've talked about today will help with that. There are techniques that we haven't even dreamed of that we will need to develop to do this. And then there's this idea of how you get that information across. Is it, you know, you can't put a label that says, here are your 42 ingredients, and this one came from here, and this one came from here, and this one came from here.
That's quite overwhelming, yeah.
It would be extremely. I mean, not only do you have to pay now attention to the nutrition and how much fat and sodium and so on and so forth is in your food product, but where were all of the ingredients from? So is there a way to label something that, you know, like the organic label, that means something in terms of the percentage of ingredients that were raised or farmed or generated in an organic production facility or using an organic production method? Can we create a label that says this has been origin certified, local certified, and, you know, you can get this already by going and talking to a local farmer at a farmer's market, but not everyone has access to a farmer's market, and farmer's markets aren't every day in every city. So how can we bring this to the consumer? And if you empower the consumer to make choices with their dollar that says, I'm going to support a food product or food producer that is from a particular region, made a particular way, then I think you can get this bottoms-up approach that Tejas mentioned. Yes, you're always going to need a top-down approach for securing supply chains and making sure that things are being produced safely and so on and so forth. You know, we need these regulations. But the bottoms-up approach with the consumer saying, I am going to show my confidence and my vote in the way that I want things to be made, and I want things to be made available to me, I would love to see that happen. I would love to be able to walk into a grocery store and just scan a shelf and say, I'm buying this, this, and this because it was made within 500 miles of me, or it was produced in Utah, and I know that it has been verified in some independent way that it meets those criteria.
Mm-hmm. To really make both the information behind that really robust and accessible, but also have the sort of structure so that people have context, so that people can know what that means. What are some of those? So you spoke about farmers markets and sort of talking to farmers directly, and that dynamic was certainly an inspiration for the scenario that I started with. But what are some other ways in which people could really get that context?
That is a good question. Not many exist today beyond talking to these food producers. So going to your local farmer, going to your farmer's market, and talking to folks. I think that we need to get more certification, and that's easy for me to say because I'm not the one that's going to be going and doing all of this work. I don't need to go and create the group that's going to certify things. But just in the same way that we had this organic certification movement, that you get a label that means something in terms of maybe I personally as a consumer did not talk to the farmer, but someone knows, someone verified in some way that this farmer produced this material, this food item in this way. So if that's a label, if it's some sort of, you know, there was a vegetable manufacturer, maybe it was a chip manufacturer a few years ago that claimed you could go and scan like a QR code on their bag of, you know, food, and it would pop up a website that would show you, here's the farm, here's the field that this came from. And that was so cool. But I would love to see that on every item so that I could just walk through with my phone and say, I'm choosing to buy this, 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 and this. And that's how I want to make my decision.
Mm-hmm. Those sort of windows. Yeah, that was, I believe Lay's did that and also Dole did that a few years ago. So more of those sort of direct windows into the origins. I had a question going back to really that where does the scale of that break down, or more I think to the point where can we transform that from something that is only realistic for very small-scale, alternatively locally produced foods, and how does that become accessible on a broader scale?
So you mean production scale, not necessarily geographic scale. Is that?
I think I'm speaking more about scale of access. So I have a question of what would it take, it looks like, to really think about you know, community gardens as a really pervasive thing of sort of access to local food being not siloed in places where the sort of personal commitment and the climate really sort of drive that access.
Well, one piece is security in the sense that Tejas mentioned, I don't care where the honey came from. I don't care how it was produced if it's the only food item that I have available to me. Mm-hmm. So making sure that people aren't worried about where their next meal is coming from, where their next, you know, grocery store trip is going to fit into their week if they have the money and the resources to go and do that. If you're always worried about that, then you can't make these choices related to now I'm going to make a decision based on where it's from or how it's produced. So we need to make sure that everyone has access to food. Now, that's we as a community, for the United States and nation, we need to make sure that everyone has access to food. As soon as you do that, it's now getting the consumer engaged into making decisions about how they want their food produced and where they want it to come from. You know, if you put a face to a name, this isn't just a farmer, this is your neighbor. Don't you want your food dollar to stay in your community and to help your neighbor? And what are the benefits to keeping your food dollar local or to supporting someone who's trying to do the quote-unquote right thing by growing things organically or letting chickens range free on a pasture or, you know, out in a I don't know what they call it, chicken runs? I think that's a movie. But, you know, how do we get the consumers to get this knowledge and then decide that this is how I want to spend my food dollar and how I want to get engaged because it benefits not only me and my health and my peace of mind, but it helps my community and my neighbors, and I'm strengthening my own surrounding area by making these choices. And that's not to say that industrial organizations aren't good to support too, but me personally, I like to know that I'm helping a quote-unquote neighbor, if that neighbor's in my state or the next state over. That would be more important to me as a consumer than saying I supported an importer of honey from another country. Giving the consumer this information and then sharing with them how important it is to make these choices, I think, is one of the pieces starting this bottom-up movement.
Mm-hmm. So really connecting that practice, that set of choices, to having food security for oneself, but also assuring food security for one's neighbors. You know, there's a quite provocative film that just came out showing that sort of charity as a way of assuring food security is sort of maxed out in our food security situation right now, and really we need to be thinking about creating relationships that assure food security rather than just going for volume and dealing with those issues and those expectations.
Miriam, can I chime in here for a bit?
Absolutely, Tim.
Okay, so I agree with everything Leslie just said. However, I think that there is a way for both of those to coexist, and I think that's the most likely future for us is, you know, there are examples of companies, industrialized food production companies, if you will, that are trying to support locally grown, locally consumed, and locally distributed products. So essentially, the way it works is almost a hybrid of what we're talking about, where possible, these food companies source locally grown ingredients, and where not possible, for a variety of factors, be it economical, be it climate change, or growing patterns or seasons, where it's not possible, they source it from a different source. So I think that's the most likely scenario where you have both of them coexisting, so to speak.
And how does I'm sorry, Leslie, go ahead.
It's a great point that Tejas makes, and I'm just going to jump in here for a second to say we actually have seen this happening. So some collaborators that I've worked with in Brazil actually went and bought Big Mac McDonald's patties, and I can say that because we published all these results, from all these different countries, and we actually analyzed the meat, the beef in those hamburger patties, and we were trying to determine, you know, you go into McDonald's worldwide and you can order the same Big Mac. And I mean that it always has the same onions and lettuce and secret sauce, and it's produced the same way. It looks the same. But isotopically, it's not, because they're sourcing local beef. And it's this idea of called glocalization. So it's a global food item that's relying on local food sources, local production, to bring these raw materials in. And that's a great example of this hybridization. You can support your local community and source the beef locally, but you're still making a quote-unquote global meal, which is, in our for our case, the Big Mac.
Now, I was going to ask you, Tejas, if you had thought in your scenarios about food defense, how that sort of more local hybridized model might affect the kinds of vulnerabilities you were looking at in that system, in those simulations.
Sorry. So essentially, there are two things that happen if you have a more local food production system. The first thing is it reduces the impact of any one particular food terrorism act, right? You can't reach a million people by attacking one locally grown, locally sourced, locally consumed food supply chain. So it certainly does reduce the impact. But in the absence of extremely good traceability, the consumers would still lose trust in that food commodity. So if this could happen to one particular area, what is stopping it from happening to my particular area? So in terms of perception, it causes a level of panic, and it causes a level of mistrust in the absence of other things like better traceability and better information and accessibility to that information to the consumer. So there are a lot of factors that influence this, and having a localized system in itself does protect the consumer in one way, but it does not solve the problem. In my view. I'll preface this. Everything I say is in my view.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And so looking at realistically the next decade and the sort of hybrid model that that sort of more localization from that perspective of food descent could really technically help us be safer, but it still might not mitigate the emotional impact that we are used to having sort of messy global sourcing, and that could have quite painful impacts for local producers in that scenario.
Well, on the flip side of that, is if you have a more localized, more distributed system, it makes it that much harder for our regulatory agencies to inspect these places and make sure that they're following the food safety standards. You know, it's already really hard for FDA to inspect all the facilities that are registered with them. So if we produce the same amount of volume of food with a distributed system, you would have an exponentially larger number of food facilities to inspect and to make sure everyone's playing by the same rules. So there's a challenge in that sense.
Now, I have a question that that I think really sort of ties some of that distinction together that we were making between food safety, food security, food defense. And the documentary I referenced is a Place at the Table. It was just released by a participant media, and it's available all over the place. But it really raises the question of if people have food, but it's not safe and not healthy and not secure, does it really solve the problem of food security? Can, from the perspective of hungry people, can that really sort of morally and ethically be disaggregated and seen as sequential? And that's it to either of you, if you would like to take that.
That's a good question. I will say that it is not my area of expertise and not something that I think you can tackle sequentially just because of the integration that Tejas has mentioned multiple times. You are going to, by working on one piece, impact another piece in that puzzle. And if you think through some of these scenarios, you can potentially impact them both beneficially in the same direction, but some changes you try to make in one area, say security, may mean that safety is not as impacted as beneficially at the same time. So how do we make these choices to try and balance all three?
If I can add to that, I agree with everything Leslie said. And, you know, I think we need to be careful when we're talking about safe foods and linking that with healthy foods. I think there is a distinction between the two. So, you know, we know that food, health, and wellness are related and they're interconnected. But hypothetically, just having access to safe food does not, even that does not just solve the problem, right? So you need to have access to safe and nutritious food. So just want to keep that in mind, that it's not just about food security versus food safety, but it's also taking it one step further.
Right, right.
So I was thinking back to your example of the Mars mission and thinking about preservation and nutrient density and how those techniques might play not only in how, you know, a food that's maybe manufactured in Brazil gets to American shelves, but how a food that's manufactured locally can last until it's needed and be available for somebody in a context that it's not available for them now. That even those sort of very cutting-edge technologies might help bear on this question if people connect those dots.
Absolutely.
I did have a question that was going back to the question of microbial management, and you mentioned sort of learning from the food manufacturing side of looking at probiotics, but in terms of how we might see that, where do you think that might emerge in restaurants, in also in sort of packaged food manufacturing or in other places?
So my comment was more about sort of a wish list from my own perspective. And the way I was looking at it was really learning from what we've seen in the pharmaceutical industry. So we've experienced and we've probably heard about the fact that the whole issue with antimicrobial drug resistant issues, it's sort of a cyclical problem where you introduce drugs that kill some bugs, and then you are left with bugs that cannot be killed by that drug. So using that concept, I was thinking that can we apply a similar concept in the food industry, where we know that foods in general will have microbes, right? It's not sterile. You cannot have sterile food because it would be a burnt brick of wood, so to speak. So it's more about commercial sterility. Is it devoid of microbes that can harm us, not devoid of all microorganisms in general? So using that concept, can we develop some technology that can introduce cultures of non-harmful microbes into our foods that would inhibit or prohibit the growth of harmful microbes? It could happen at the food processing level. It could happen at the consumer level. Because I don't know what the technology looks like, it could be that along with your table salt, you add some cultures that destroys any harmful microorganisms. I don't know. I've learned that science fiction is a very strong driving force to future innovation. So if we see this 10 years from now, just remember to credit me.
And that's sort of proactive, actually changing either a chemical or a microbial level, the nutrient density and the microbial safety of food. That seems like something that is really complementary but very different than many of the techniques that we've been discussing here today, which are around traceability, which really hinge on inspection and testing and sort of a situational awareness. And I have a question here about what are some alternatives to that in terms of thinking holistically about food safety, to just sort of making the systems for testing and being aware and inspecting food better. What else could we do to really assure the safety of food? As a tricky question, I know.
So I'll try and take a first crack at that.
Thank you, Dana.
So there was an interesting perspective I had read somewhere, and I forget the source, so I apologize, but there was a whole thing about we are seeing more and more rapid testing methodologies being developed in a way that with the hopes of identifying contaminations and contaminants as quickly as possible to prevent illnesses from happening. However, as an unintended side effect of that, we're seeing that if a rapid test is used to identify a contaminant, it breaks down our entire system that we have in place today to identify outbreaks. And without identifying outbreaks, we cannot go back to the source of that contaminant to find out what happened, what went wrong, and how to fix it. So I think one of the things we can do to improve food safety is not just try and make things faster, better, cheaper, but to do some kind of a life cycle analysis of new technology, new methods, new protocols, and trying to make sure that we have taken into account all the possible scenarios and all the possible ways that this technology can be used and misused. You know, hopefully we don't trade a short-term benefit for a long-term harm.
Mm-hmm. So more thoughtful, precise innovation, basically.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I am just going to second that. Is that cheating? I think Tejas had a very good answer to that.
I have another question that is about going back to that distinction and that caution that you issued, Tejas, about distinguishing food safety and the healthfulness of food. I have a question about the current controversy around sugar and its health effects and the sort of nascent movement to get sugar removed from the generally recognized as safe list as a sort of convergence of timely example of precisely that kind of convergence between safety and healthfulness. So I was wondering if either of you have any comment on that.
So if I can say this, and I'm saying this as a food scientist, it's all about moderation, right? I could drown myself in a sea of salt, but that makes salt unsafe. Or would that make me stupid? You know, I'd read this somewhere, I can't remember where, I think it was at an airport or something, where it said 100% of people that drink water die. And that's true. Does that make water harmful? No, not really. So I believe in moderation. I think everything in the right amount is good for you. The whole debate around sugar in food is not sugar itself, but it's the amount of sugar available to us in all the foods that we consume. So it's about personal responsibility for me. It's about choices that I make myself. And then there are food scientists in the food industry working on not just methods to reduce the amount of sugar, but how to make the food taste just as good.
So that gets to the changing the sort of basic situation where so many of our foods have such high levels of sugar and sodium that it's sort of there really isn't a choice. So kind of changing, really going back to the chemistry and changing that situation and seeing if we can create some alternatives or completely replace things that are harmful for us without sacrificing taste and those things that we love so much.
Right, and this goes back to the whole discussion we had about consumer information and access to information. The more the consumers know about the foods that they eat today, the better choices they will hopefully make.
And I'll jump in here to say, if I may, that it's not only choice, but knowing that you have the choice, but then you are choosing to spend your dollar in a certain way, and that is a signal that now, okay, there is a market for this, people are enjoying this, they're going to pay for this, we'll offer more and more choices that are quote-unquote healthier.
Which is really what we've seen over the last 10 years, and we're starting to see a little bit more of what Tejas was talking about, of changing the baseline from which those choices are made. Let's see. I think we have time for maybe one more question. And let's see. So we had a question going back to packaging and the role of packaging in food safety. And we've seen, the packaging as a way of keeping food safe from very basic contaminants is age old. Also, we've had sort of packaging-specific contamination challenges in the past. We have signals coming of sort of smart packaging that will alert us of the safety of food. What are some other ways in which the packaging can help us assure a sort of safe food supply?
Well, I'll start here first, if I may, and say that I think packaging, in terms of labeling, is starting to provide a lot more information. So we've talked a lot about consumer choice, and if you want consumers to make a choice, you have to supply them information. Now, you can go into information overload. So I'm already, like I mentioned, and we talked about earlier, we can't list where every single ingredient comes from. People just can't process that. They're going to spend 3 hours in the grocery store buying groceries because they have to read, 42 things on a label. So
or they just can't read them at that point.
Well, that's true. Can we make the label interactive in the sense that, I'm making a choice based on a diet restriction. So I want to know how much sodium is in something. And so I need the packaging to display that information to me first and most clearly. My friend, however, is really interested in eating organically. And so sodium content is not as important to her. She wants information on sodium content. So can these labels evolve or be modified in some way to show me the information that I need as a consumer to make the particular decision that's important to me? And that is a safety concern that is different from just is the material inside, has it been kept free from contaminants and not exposed to the atmosphere and so on and so forth, but the packaging is actually giving me information so that I can make a choice.
Mm-hmm. Or dynamic role that it's playing in that information.
Yeah.
Thank you. It does?
For the exact same reasons that Leslie just mentioned, packaging also has a very similar role to play when it comes to food traceability. How do we keep track of where the products are coming from, where they're going? It's all about the package, right? It can be a barcode, it can be RFID, it can be something else that we haven't thought of yet, but packaging has a role to play in trying to figure out and in instilling trust to the consumer that what you're getting within that package is what we're saying it is.
And there's a relationship between that barcode and the kinds of sort of intentionally added isotopes that you mentioned towards the beginning, which is sort of like a chemical barcode that you could imagine in situations where there's this company, WikiCell, that's producing edible packaging that is a sort of spin on the contents of the package itself that has some integrity. And you could imagine that sort of combining so that even packaging like that could convey information both in the system and to consumers. Great.
Absolutely.
Well, I thank you both very much. I very much appreciate you joining us today. Thank you, everyone
who
joined us on the phone and in WebEx. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Morning. Or afternoon, wherever you are in the world. Thank you. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.